We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomczyk, local writer and activist here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'm still getting used to afternoon versus morning. It's only going to take another year.
Uh-huh.
All right.
Yeah, I know, Mike.
Yeah, well, it's just another indicator why we need a more robust healthcare system. So, no job today. He will hopefully be back next week.
Yeah.
We're at the time of the year where you two begin to switch off.
A little bit. Uh-huh.
Get busy on things. But still just as much to cover. And starting out with local and city council and decisions this week, votes regarding MHA.
Yeah. On Monday, the city council passed by an 8-0 vote the mandatory housing affordability legislation. They passed it out of the select committee that was set up to deal with the MHA upzoning. All 9 council members are members of this committee, but Mike O'Brien was absent that day. The council voted on a number of amendments. Some were district-based amendments. Others were broader amendments to the zoning process itself. In general, Rob Johnson and Deborah Juarez had proposed amendments to upzone certain areas of their own districts. That would be districts 4 and 5. University District on all the way up through Northeast Seattle where and much of North Seattle where Deborah Juarez has her district, District 5. On the other hand, as opposed to Lisa Herbold, Bruce Harrell, and Mike O'Brien, who had proposed amendments to decrease upzones in portions of their districts, Districts 1 and 2, which cover West Seattle all the way through South Seattle, and District 6, which is northwest Seattle, north of the Ship Canal. And then Shama Sawant largely sat this out because, of course, you know, upzoning's a done deal pretty much in her neighborhood from Capitol Hill on down to through the Central District. And Sally Bagshaw made only one proposed amendment for exempting historical buildings and properties from the upzoning process. Again, her district from Magnolia to through Queen Anne, all the way down through Belltown and downtown. That's all sort of previously been upzoned. So there weren't a whole lot of changes that she wanted to propose. Most of the amendments to decrease upzones didn't pass. There were a few notable exceptions, though. There were a group of amendments that Mike O'Brien had proposed for the Crown Hill area, and some of his most vocal critics in his own District 6 were against upzoning single-family housing in Crown Hill, and this group of amendments is going to restrict most of that upzoning to 15th Avenue Northwest, which folks who are lower income who live in that neighborhood were looking at that and saying, that's not so great because 15th Avenue Northwest has a lot of noise pollution. There's a lot of traffic. It would be great if people could live a little bit away from the main drag. But no, the owners of single family homes were very much against upzoning anything but properties along 15th Avenue Northwest. Another exception was a group of amendments for West Seattle Junction. And that group of amendments that put off upzoning that area passed because council members wanted to wait until Sound Transit decides where to put the light rail station in that neighborhood. That decision should come later this year. Sound Transit is currently holding public hearings on the alignment of a West Seattle to Ballard Link light rail line and station locations for West Seattle and for an international district station are the two most hotly debated right now on this alignment. So there's a 7 to 10 block difference in where stations could be placed in West Seattle. So until that's finalized, the city council basically agreed that it didn't make sense to look at upzoning in that neighborhood until they know where the light rail station's going to go. Also removed entirely from that upzoning process is the new Ravenna-Cowan Historical District. Its boundaries are 12th Avenue Northeast on its western edge, Northeast 65th Street to the north, and then it stretches south and east to encompass Cowan Park and Ravenna Park, including the Ravine. Its eastern edge is 23rd Avenue Northeast. So not a huge area, but it does encompass the parks and the neighborhoods that kind of that are around those parks in a crescent to the north of them and a little bit to the west and the east of the two parks. There are a lot of older homes that were built in the 30s and 40s there, and some beautifully well kept up homes. Of course, very expensive properties too, because of those older historic homes and the great shape that they're in. But Rob Johnson was particularly against that historical district because even though I think he voted for the amendments, he did it kind of biting his tongue because it's really close to the new light rail, where the new light rail station is going to go in on Roosevelt. And that whole area is slated for upzoning. So a lot of the property owners in that area had talked about not expanding the upzoning out to cover what are right now single family home areas. But those amendments did not pass. Those failed. So the upzone is going to go not south to the Ravenna-Cowan area, but north of where the light rail station is to all of those single family homes north of 65th Street. Now, the MHA bill will be up for final approval by the council on March 18th. Lisa Herbold is also hoping to have a final version of her bill ready on that date. Her bill requires developers in five neighborhoods of Seattle to provide one-to-one replacement for affordable housing or pay a higher fee into the city's affordable housing fund. Those five neighborhoods are Bitter Lake in North Seattle. That's between 105th Street and 145th Street, and between Aurora Avenue and Greenwood Avenue. That's the Bitter Lake area. Othello, which is around South Othello Street and MLK Way, which is currently undergoing some gentrification because of the Othello Street light rail station there. South Park, which is west of Boeing Field. Rainier Beach, which is southeast of Boeing Field, right on Lake Washington, probably the last bastion of affordable housing anywhere near Lake Washington. And the Westwood Highland Park area, which is on the very southern border of the city, up the hill from Lincoln Park and the Fauntleroy neighborhood. Those are according to a study done by the city council, some of the areas that have that some of the remaining areas in the city of Seattle that still have large tracts of affordable housing in them. And Lisa Herbold would like to have something, an ordinance in place that requires developers in those neighborhoods that she's designated, that the city council has evaluated as having large amounts of affordable housing. She would like developers to replace that affordable housing, not just push people out and gentrify.
I think there's probably a lot of people that would like that.
Yes, there are a lot of people who would like that, I'm sure.
Yeah, but none of them are are developers.
No, because, it's about the money, right?
I think that's why they get into the business.
Yes, I think so, too. So City Council had other business this week, too. It passed bonuses for Seattle Police Department hires on Wednesday. They passed out of the Gender Equity Safe Communities New Americans and Education Committee a bill to authorize the Seattle Police Department to pay $15,000 hiring bonuses to police officers that they can poach from other law enforcement agencies. The mayor had proposed this bill to the city council. Council member Lorena Gonzalez proposed some very common sense amendments to the bill. First off, that an officer could receive the bonus only once. Kind of a surprise that that's not in the bill, was not in the original version of the bill from the mayor's office, but that's to prevent an officer from taking the bonus, working at the SPD for a year, then going to a different department for a year, and then coming back and getting the bonus again. The second amendment she added was that the city budget office find a way to link the bonus to the amount of time an officer stays with the department, up to 5 years after they've been hired, either in the form of installment payments over that five-year period. So, for example, a $15,000 bonus, that would be $3,000 for every year that they complete of their five-year agreement, or a requirement that they pay back the bonus or a prorated amount of the bonus if they leave before the five-year time period had elapsed. And that's pretty common practice with a lot of private companies, when they pay a hiring bonus, it's often contingent on how long a person has stayed with the company. So they may say, if you're here at the end of 6 months, we'll pay you the full amount of the hiring bonus. You know, we'll pay you X amount up front, we'll pay you the rest after you've completed 6 months or a year, sometimes 2 years. 5 years is a little long. And when it goes before the full council, that might get amended to a lower timeline of maybe 3 years, 2 years, or maybe even less than that. But the fact that the original bill didn't include that was a little bit of a surprise, too. The third amendment that Gonzalez proposed is that the SPD also be allowed to offer $7,500 bonuses to new recruits as an incentive for more people of color to work in the department. Because often when an agency like the Seattle Police Department hires from other police agencies, they're looking at experienced hires, and that is typically white men. Not as many women, not as many people of color. And Gonzalez is, you know, this is the committee in which she's looking at opportunities for people of color. And that has been her focus on the city council for some time. So this was a good idea. The Seattle Police Department is having trouble filling the ranks. So provide a hiring bonus to new hires as well, and try to look at a little bit of racial equity in your and gender equity in your hiring. So, and then she proposed two more additions. One is that the SPD track whether the new bonus is successful in bringing more officers into the department at a faster rate, which makes sense, right? And finally, she added a termination clause so that the program would end on December 31st, 2019, unless the council reviews and then decides to extend the ability of the Seattle Police Department to pay bonuses when they hire people instead of just letting them do it forever until it's repealed. All of these were very good, very common sense amendments. And again, the fact that the bill lacked them in the first place really shows how police friendly Mayor Durkan and her office is, to the extent that it makes her fiscally irresponsible, I think, because most of these amendments are good fiscal policy. The one bonus per officer rule, in particular, the attempt to link the bonus to tenure, is also a very fiscally responsible bill because it costs money to hire people and train them, particularly when you've got a new police reform process where you're training officers more to deal with things like racial equity and use of force and on new use of force policies. It makes sense to try to encourage new hires to stay. And of course, to ask for statistics on whether the bonus is having the effect intended. That all makes a lot of sense. Now, that brings us, the fact that Mayor Durkan didn't have those in her bill in the first place, it was just, let's let the Seattle Police Department pay $15,000 bonuses, period. You know, no restrictions on there at all, no follow through at all.
Which is interesting if you compare it with their new policies since she's become mayor for the focusing on the homelessness issues, you know, they're constantly including.
We'll talk about that a little bit more. But yeah, this whole idea that homelessness services have to be data driven, have to be based on certain metrics. But the Seattle Police Department, I guess they don't have to adhere to any metrics at all. Which brings us to the court monitor, Merrick Bob, the court appointed monitor of the police reform process in Seattle. And he gave his report this week to U.S. District Judge James Robart. Bob said that while he thinks the SPD is making strides in changing its use of force policies and in using de-escalation tactics, he's concerned about the new Seattle Police Officers Guild contract. He said that he can't yet come to a conclusion over whether the Seattle Police Department, quote, remains or does not remain in compliance in whole or in part, end quote, with the Department of Justice mandated police reforms. He noted that 55% of African American respondents to community surveys say that they think the SPD often uses excessive force. 69% of Black respondents said that the SPD often racially profiles African Americans, and 28% of them said it happens very often. Together, that's 97% of all African American respondents to three separate surveys in the city of recent surveys in the city of Seattle. That plus the concerns that Judge Robart, the Community Police Commission, and community groups have raised about the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract has led Merrick Bobb to say that he just can't make a judgment right now. And that's kind of interesting because, you know, the city attorneys and the Trump administration's Department of Justice attorneys have both urged Judge Robart to rule that the Seattle Police Department and the city are in full compliance. And I think that Judge Robart, who appointed Merrick Bobb as the monitor of the reform process, would have liked Bobb to have made a decision one way, made a decisive judgment one way or the other as to whether this new contract and these surveys that show there could still be, or at least in the perception of the African-American community, that the Seattle Police Department is still engaging in racially divisive and racial profiling tactics. That's still going on. And I think I kind of agree with that assessment that I would have liked Merrick Bobb to say, well, they've made some progress, but they're not in full compliance yet. And instead, he kind of took this middle line of saying, I can't make a decision right now. Kind of like the city council did when they passed the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract. They said, we're just going to put it in the lap of the judge. Judge James Robart, it seems like that's what Merrick Bobb has done as well.
What do you suspect the motivations on not making a decision one way or the other on that?
I think he's getting a lot of pressure from the city to say, come on, it's time to end this. And he may be getting pressure from the Department of Justice, from the Trump administration's Department of Justice to say, come on, let's wrap this up. You know, we're done with it. How come you guys are still dragging your feet on saying that the city's in compliance? I think that's probably why. And I think that that's really unfortunate.
Is the Justice Department his boss on this?
He is supposed to be independent and he answers only to the court. However, that doesn't mean that he can't be subject to some pressure from the feds. You know, but they're the ones who did the initial evaluation that said that the Seattle Police Department needs to undergo this reform process because the department has problems with their use of force policies and that they suspected that there was a racial profiling component that needed to be addressed, a racial justice component that needed to be addressed. And now that they're saying, nope, city's in full compliance, there's a lot of pressure, even if they don't pay his salary, even if he doesn't answer to them, to say, okay, yeah, everything's good now.
All right, so it then is going to fall on...
fall on the judge to make that decision.
Which will happen...
We don't know yet, okay. But judges have their own timeline, and they have to review all the documents, which is why they have their own timeline. So we just have to wait.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Further developments this week regarding our homelessness emergency situation here in Seattle?
Yeah, the Human Services Department released the results of its homeless services program for 2018. And just like Mayor Durkan, the report exaggerates the numbers. Durkan claimed in her State of the City address that the city had helped 7,400 people exit homelessness in 2018. And, you know, that number seemed preposterous on the face of it when she said it. But the Human Services Department tried to claim something very similar this week. In its press release, which you can see published on the city's Human Interest blog, it's their press release is headlined, quote, 2018 homeless exits to permanent housing up 30%, end quote. It says in the second paragraph, it's another quote, there were a total set of 7,428 household exits from homeless programs to permanent housing, end quote. So they're saying essentially the same thing that Mayor Durkan said. But you have to read down through the entire document to the second to last paragraph in an italicized section titled Methodology for Reporting. And that's the kind of thing that most people skip over, right? And it really looks like it's just a little footnote, actually a rather large footnote, but you have to read it because it says, quote, one client may stay in a shelter and work with a rapid rehousing program before leaving both programs to enter permanent housing. Each of those program exits counts as an exit to permanent housing. Okay, so what does that mean? That means that one person could be responsible for two exits to permanent housing. So they could be double counting or more than double counting, triple or quadruple counting each person. So those exits to homelessness is really a meaningless number because we don't know how many people were counted once, twice, three times, four times, five times, et cetera. And the city offers a wide range of different programs that a homeless person might utilize. Everything from food programs to drug treatment to on the job to job training to, you know, homeless to shelter services, you know, just a huge number of programs that could be counted in that. In addition, the statistics seem to be counting people who have not become homeless yet, too, but who the city classifies as maintaining their existing housing by taking advantage of city services. And that comes to at least 1,800 people in this count, although that number is not actually easy to verify either. So, you know, here we have the city's human services department saying essentially that it doesn't have any clear numbers on how many people they've actually moved into housing in the past year. They're admitting that in this report, even though they're doing their best to camouflage it. This comes after Mayor Durkin boasted that the city would be using data-based criteria for deciding which service providers to fund. So they're trying to hold service providers accountable by counting the number of people or what they claim as exits from homelessness. And yet the city itself can't hold itself accountable for counting the number of actual people it's housed.
Did they put the word exits like in quotes?
No, they don't. So put the word exits in quotes.
Playing pretty fast.
Yeah, they're playing fast and loose. Yeah. But the data they're using is misleading, if not utterly incomprehensible. You can't really draw conclusions from it. And it appears to be that way by design because King County uses the same sources for their data. And yet they can actually count the number of people that they've housed. And they actually provide that in very clear terminology. And it's a mystery as to why the city of Seattle can't do the same, except that that you can draw the inference that the city of Seattle doesn't want to count the actual number of people because that actual number is too low. They want to count this false metric called exits, because they can say, look, 7,000, that's a lot of people. It's not a lot of people. It's a lot of meaningless numbers is what it is. So this is why so many different service providers, not just ShareWheel, but many other service providers are opposed to Jason Johnson becoming the new head of the Human Services Department. He's been a big supporter of this meaningless data regime. And he's been overseeing it as the interim director and previously before that as the deputy director. So he's all gung-ho for it. He thinks it's great. He's not sure why anybody has a problem with this quote-unquote story is what he called it. He responded to Lisa Herbold when she said, look, there's a problem with your statistics here. You're not counting the actual people. He may have been responding to reporters too when he said, well, maybe we have to look at our data and how it's presented to give you a better picture of the story, you know, as if truth doesn't matter. What matters is the story here. And that's, I think, a very good reason to not allow Jason Johnson to become the head of the Human Services Department for the city.
So they're big on telling stories now at HSD.
Yes. It's all a big story.
Yeah. Gather around the fire. That's a story to tell you.
Yeah.
All right. And that was the same week. I don't know if you caught it, but it looked like there might be some additional scrutiny over ShareWheel this week with additional focus.
After the city council approved funding for ShareWheel through the end of 2020 in their 2-year budget bill, the city, the mayor's office, and actually I should say the Human Services Department announced that they were ending the contract for ShareWheel. They were putting a six-month limit on the contract for ShareWheel, after which they would evaluate whether to extend the contract, which seems to be a contradiction in terms, right? The funding's there for ShareWheel, and yet the city wants to end the contract with them. So that had Chama Sawant asking, what the heck is this? Is this retaliation for the fact that ShareWheel has been so vocal against Jason Johnson? Lisa Herbold asked about it, and she seemed to think that it was just part of the Human Services Department's new way of doing business to try to get eight different service providers to provide them the statistics they want for their meaningless data sets. I don't see that as a good sign either, but she seemed okay with that. And I have to say, I'm leaning more with Chama Sawant here. I think it is retaliation for ShareWheel being very vocal in their opposition to Jason Johnson.
So they're looking at doing some more story rewriting there.
I guess.
Huh. Okay. before we jump to the state legislature, mm-hmm. Should mention also this week there was development with Amazon apparently backing out of one of their prior.
Well, Amazon has two big projects under construction. One was they were going to be leasing about 700,000 square feet in the Rainier Tower complex that's being built downtown. It's huge complex being built to replace the old Rainier Tower. And they also are building, they're building what they have called the last piece of their South Lake Union campus. Now, this week, Amazon said that they are backing out of occupying the space that they are leasing in the Rainier Tower complex. They are not going to be putting in offices to have anywhere from 5,000 to 7,000 people in that space. They're going to sublease it instead, which is like I pointed out earlier when they threatened this over the repeal of the head tax, when they threatened, oh, you need to do something about this tax. You can't levy it on us, or we're going to leave downtown Seattle. We're going to leave South Lake Union. They had threatened only to sublease that Rainier Tower space. They hadn't actually threatened to break the lease and walk away. They hadn't threatened to sell any of their actual property in South Lake Union. And here they are doing it anyway. You know, after the city of Seattle, after the city council and the mayor all panicked and said, oh no, we have to repeal the head tax or Amazon's going to leave Seattle. Amazon said, great, thank you for repealing the head tax. Well, by the way, we aren't coming into downtown anyway. So that was their announcement this week, essentially saying that, we made this business decision. We just essentially what they were saying was, oh, yeah, we'd already made this business decision. It's a business decision. It's not related to any kind of taxing thing that the city of Seattle tried to pull. So it seems really clear that they took something that was going to be just a business decision and they announced it early in order to use it as political leverage against the city of Seattle, requiring large companies to pay a small tax in order to support affordable housing. That's apparently their tactics and something that other cities should be aware of too.
All right. Excuse me, on to Olympia.
Bills in the state legislature. Mm. Yeah, this week was the climate change edition of bills in the state legislature. There are two very big bills I want to talk about. One is Senate Bill 5116, Senator Reuben Carlisle's clean energy bill, which passed the Senate and is now on its way to the House. It would require all electrical utilities in the state of Washington to be 100% carbon neutral by the year 2030 and 100% carbon free by the year 2045. Now, I read through the bill. I didn't read every section closely, but I read through the primary sections of the bill. Carbon neutral means that a utility must invest in carbon reduction programs and renewable resources that can offset 100% of its carbon producing operations. And then by 2045, they would have to have no carbon producing operations at all. That's what carbon free means. Arguably, I think that timeline should be sped up to 2025 for carbon neutral and 2030 for carbon free for those two deadlines. But the bill has some other good, very good pieces to it, particularly the penalty for not reaching those deadlines, a fee of $60 per megawatt hour of electricity production that produces carbon pollution above the targets set in the bill. And that fee gets adjusted every 2 years for inflation starting in the year 2027. It also includes a sales tax break on the purchases of machinery and equipment that are used to generate electricity from renewable resources. A little help there for electric utilities that will have to spend a lot of money to change the way that they generate electricity, but particularly for Puget Sound Energy, which is the main utility in the state that gets something like 70% of its electricity generation is fossil fuel based. Now, it's also tackling the conversion of the utility sector. And of course, that's the easy part of ending our greenhouse gas emissions because the technology is already there to do that. And it's something that the state legislature should be able to easily accomplish this year, is to get a bill passed that would start the conversion of the electricity sector. That's our third largest source of carbon emissions. The harder part is to deal with number one and number two. Number one is the transportation sector. Number two is the amount of carbon production we see in our buildings, particularly large warehouse buildings, large commercial buildings that use a lot of electricity and produce have a lot of electricity waste in them. Now, Senate Bill 5971 is the other big bill that I want to talk about. It's part of three transportation budget bills in the Senate Transportation Committee. One of them tackles the expense side of the transportation budget, what projects are going to be built. One authorizes the state to issue bonds to pay for certain transportation projects. And SB 5971 lists the other funding sources for transportation projects. Number one on that list, and the largest one, is a new carbon pollution fee that would start on July 1st, 2020. The state would charge $15 per metric ton of carbon dioxide emissions on the sale of fossil fuels in the state of Washington, except fuels used by electrical utilities within the state. And that's it would be levied on electricity generated in other states from fossil fuels that is then imported into Washington state. And it's clearly meant to be a companion bill to Senate Bill 5116, which I just talked about, which already levies a cost on electrical utilities by requiring them to purchase a lot of new equipment to convert their electricity generating to carbon-free sources. But more importantly, this bill is tackling the transportation sector, which is the state's biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions and probably the heaviest lift in the state in terms of getting us to being carbon free. Senate Bill 5971 is in the Senate Transportation Committee undergoing review and possible amendments. So it will change. Obviously, there will be some amendments to it. And because it's a budget bill, there's no cutoff date for when it has to pass out of the committee or pass either house, except for the date when the legislative session ends. So it could pass any day now onto the Senate floor and be passed out of the Senate to the House, or it could linger until the last minute, and there could be last minute votes on it. So there's no cutoff deadline for it to get out of the Senate Transportation Committee. One of the suggested amendments to the bill that I think people should be contacting their representatives about would be to repeal the poison pill provision that the Republicans passed into law in 2015 in their transportation budget that prevents the state from implementing a low carbon fuel standard before July 1st, 2023, or else risk losing funding for transit projects. That the bill really needs to include a repeal of that provision. And I think folks should be contacting their state senators and telling them that needs to happen. for this Senate transportation bill to pass, that SB 5971 needs to repeal the poison pill on low carbon fuel standards that the Republicans passed in 2015.
No poison pill.
Yeah, there were a couple other bills that passed too. There's a Senate Bill 5395 is a comprehensive sex education bill for the state's school children. It passed the Senate and has been taken up by the Education Committee in the House and has a really good chance of passing in the House this year because House Democrats have a very strong majority there. It requires every school in the state to provide comprehensive instruction on sexual education. It sets standards for the curriculum, including that it be medically and scientifically accurate, that it discusses various methods of birth control, not just abstinence only, and that it addresses healthy relationships based on mutual respect and affection that are free from violence, coercion, and intimidation. Classes must be offered at all grade levels, and they have to be age appropriate. So, for example, elementary school kids would be discussing things like feelings, how to recognize who's a friend and who's not, what is safe versus unwanted touching, what to do in a potentially dangerous or uncomfortable situation, et cetera. Things that are very age appropriate. They wouldn't be discussing, you know, contraception at that age. Now, the kind of things that a parent would want their kids, their very young children, to know, you know, how to tell who's a friend and who's not, what's safe versus something that makes you uncomfortable, what to do if you're uncomfortable, that kind of thing. Of course, the bill also contains a provision for parents who want to pull their kids out of these classes if they want their kids to remain completely clueless, although that's not likely these days because kids talk to each other. So you can pull your kid out of a class like that, but their friends are going to tell them anyway. Now, another bill that passed is Senate Bill 5649, which extends the statute of limitations for sex offenses. Under current law, the statute of limitations for rape and other sex offenses most sex offenses is 3 years after the crime is committed. This bill would remove the time limit entirely for first and second degree rape of a person under the age of 16 and for first, second, and third degree rape and sexual misconduct in the first degree of a child. It also removes the time limit for prosecuting child molestation. In addition, it increases the statute of limitation for first and second degree rape of a person over 16 from the current 3 years to 20 years. For third degree rape and incest, the statute of limitations would increase to 10 years. That bill passed the Senate and is now in the House Public Safety Committee. And I really think it points out that there's now an understanding that victims of rape and sexual abuse are uniquely vulnerable. And it can take a long period of time for them to get enough courage to pursue justice and a criminal conviction. That's especially true with people who were abused as children. So I think this bill is a very, very good response to the hashtag MeToo movement. That's Senate Bill 5649.
All right. Any other developments on
let's move to national first. Okay. I'd just like to say if you're a fan of this show and you really appreciate what you hear on KODX, we're an all-volunteer organization and we need your support. So if you want to become a patron of KODX, you can go to our website at kodxseattle.org, click on the Patreon button, and make a regular contribution to the station. You can also send us checks made out to Earth on the Air Independent Media and mail them to P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. And we'll repeat that address at the end of the show.
Yeah. And big thanks to everybody who gave last week.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we do really appreciate that, and it is a big help to us.
So Washington State Attorney General finally speaks up this week.
Yeah, Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson announced that he will be suing the Trump administration over its new abortion policy. On Friday, February 22nd, the Trump administration announced that it would pull federal funding from any family planning clinics that provide referrals for abortion services. Clinics could talk to patients about abortion, but could not tell them where to go to get one. In addition, clinics would no longer be required to provide women with all the options available to them, which means that anti-abortion groups could now, for the first time, qualify for federal funding under Title X. Also, organizations that receive that federal funding under Title X could still perform abortions, but they would have to perform them in an entirely separate facility with separate financial accounting. Of course, no Title X funding is currently used for abortions, and that's long been the case. Title X funding is used for all sorts of reproductive health care, from breast and cervical cancer screening to treatment for sexually transmitted diseases to counseling women on their options for birth control. Now, it sends $286 million to more than 4,000 clinics in the U.S. About 40% of those clinics are run by Planned Parenthood, which uses about 21% of that funding, or about $60 million in total, for family planning services and for reproductive health treatment. Many clinics would not be able to split into two separate locations. It would be prohibitively expensive for them, and they would be forced to close their doors, leaving many patients, the vast majority of them low-income, women of color, or rural residents with nowhere to go for those services. On Monday, Washington State Attorney General Bob Ferguson announced that he is filing a lawsuit against that new policy, calling it, quote, a transparent attack on Planned Parenthood, end quote. Ferguson pointed out that the law requires doctors to lie to their patients. If patients ask for a referral to an abortion provider, the doctor can't give them a single name. He or she has to give them a list of doctors that includes at least some doctors who don't perform abortions on that list. The list could not include reproductive health clinics or organizations like Planned Parenthood that are not also primary care doctors. So it's only a list of primary care doctors, and it has to include a mix of doctors, some who do perform abortions and some who don't. That's essentially lying to your patients, saying, okay, here's a list of doctors that you can contact, and then some of those doctors don't actually provide that service. That's lying to your patients. He said that over 90,000 patients in Washington state are seen in clinics that receive Title X funding. Nearly 90% of those patients are treated at Planned Parenthood clinics. He called the new policy a violation of the Affordable Care Act, a violation of the Administrative Procedures Act, because it contradicts the original Title X regulations without providing a sufficient justification. And doesn't that sound familiar? And that it's also a violation of free speech and a woman's right to an abortion under Roe v. Wade.
All right. Moving on, appears Congress responded this week to Trump's border emergency.
Yeah. The House voted this week, 245 to 182, to overturn Donald Trump's phony state of emergency declaration on funding for construction of his border wall. 13 Republicans joined the Democrats in that vote. I just want to give you my quote of the week, which is House Speaker Nancy Pelosi saying on the floor of the House, quote, "Is your oath of office to Donald Trump or is it to the Constitution of the United States?" End quote. That was her speaking to the House Republicans, asking them why they were voting against this bill to block Donald Trump's emergency over funding for his border wall. The Senate is now required to take up that bill. They can't just ignore it. Three Republican senators have said that they will vote for it: Susan Collins of Maine, Tom Tillis of North Carolina, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. And so the Senate only needs one more Republican senator to say that they will vote for it in order to pass that bill. Two other Republican senators are considering voting for it, but haven't announced yet. One is Rand Paul of Kentucky, who tends to lean to the libertarian side. He's tends to be very fiscally conservative, too. And I think he thinks that if Congress has said, no, you don't get the money, that no, you don't get the money. And Ted Cruz of Texas, who ran against Trump for the presidency, if you'll remember, Donald Trump nicknamed Ted Cruz Lion Ted. So it's very possible that Ted Cruz could come out and vote for it. We'll see. Now, the House also passed two gun safety bills this week. the first ones to pass Congress in 25 years. Of course, they've only passed the House. The likelihood that they will get picked up in the Senate is rather small, but let's talk a little bit about them. One is the Bipartisan Background Checks Act. It would require background checks for all firearm sales, including guns sold at gun shows and through online sales, which in the era of online sales really makes sense, because certainly you can do background checks online. You don't have to be a big gun dealer with a brick and mortar store to do that. And the second bill was the Enhanced Background Checks Act, which gives the FBI 10 days instead of 3 days in which to complete a background check before a person is allowed to buy a gun. Currently, under the three-day law, if the FBI doesn't respond or sign off on a background check, then a person can go ahead and buy a gun on day four. And that's how Dylann Roof got his hands on the gun that he used to kill 9 people at an African-American church in Charleston, South Carolina. Roof was a known white supremacist with a history of drug violations, and he would not have qualified. He would not have passed the background check if the background check law had allowed more than 3 days for the FBI to respond. So that's a very good and very common sense bill. But like I say, the Republicans would vote them down, would vote these bills down in the Senate. However, if you're in a state, if you're listening from out of state and you're in a state with a Republican senator, call your Republican senator and say that you want them to vote yes. Bring those bills to the Senate and vote yes on them.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Well, there was earlier this week, the Michael Cohen testifying before the House Committee on
Oversight and Reform.
Yeah.
There was lots of name calling by Republicans, and even Donald Trump's kids, akin to, you know, liar, liar, pants on fire, essentially not really addressing much of what Michael Cohen was saying, other than to continually say again and again, he's a liar, he's a liar, he's a liar, he's a liar. But then Cohen, you know, after saying a few things, produced the actual checks with Donald Trump's signature on them, and checks with the signature of Donald Trump Jr. and I believe it's Alan Weisselberg is the name of his chief financial officer of the Trump Organization. And those checks really prove that, yes, Donald Trump's son and his CFO were all complicit in the Stormy Daniels bribery scandal and campaign violations. So, they can call you a liar, but if you have the documentary evidence, it's there. When I want to also say, too, that it really points out the hypocrisy of the Republicans in Congress, because they kept saying, well, you know, you've lied to Congress before, Cohen. You know, how can we believe you now? And that's an exact echo of what Ilhan Omar had said, a freshman Democrat had said in a committee when Elliot Abrams recently testified about Venezuela. She said to him, how can we believe anything you say when you've lied to Congress before and been convicted of lying to Congress before in the Iran-Contra scandal? And at that time, the Republicans on the committee just piled on her and forced her to back down. But in this case, the Republicans were happy to pile on Michael Cohen. I guess the difference there is that Elliot Abrams is a loyal liar, whereas Michael Cohen is a disloyal liar. So one is a good person and the other one is not in the eyes of the Republicans. So I also want to say, too, that Cohen had said that when he previously lied to Congress, talking about Trump's involvement in the Moscow Tower deal and how it ended in January 2016 instead of later in 2016, as he is now saying is the case, Trump's lawyers had reviewed and edited his earlier statement that he gave to Congress, in which he is accused of lying to Congress. So that's something that should be considered as well, that if he lied, it wasn't of his own volition. Now, he also claimed to be in Trump's office when Trump took the call from Roger Stone, put Stone on speakerphone and then listened as Stone said that he had just talked to Julian Assange of WikiLeaks and that in a couple of days, WikiLeaks would be publishing a bunch of emails that would damage Hillary Clinton's campaign. That was in mid-2016, in July of 2016. He also implicated Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner via the June 2016 Trump Tower meeting with Russians who claimed to have dirt on Hillary Clinton and who were obviously ready to trade something to get that dirt on Hillary Clinton, although he didn't say what that was and probably couldn't say what that might have been. Cohen described Trump as a serial liar, someone who inflated his net worth, cheated on his taxes, didn't pay his bills, committed insurance fraud, and got his way by threatening people over and over and over again. For example, Cohen was tasked with writing threatening letters to sue Donald Trump's high school, colleges, and the College Board if they released his SAT scores or his grades during his presidential campaign. Cohen also reported several of Trump's racist comments. And eventually, near the end of his testimony, he worried that if Donald Trump didn't win re-election, that, quote, there will never be a peaceful transition of power, end quote, which is perhaps the scariest thing that he said on Wednesday. Now, if even a fraction of what Cohen says is true, Trump is truly in trouble if he doesn't win re-election, because then he no longer has immunity from prosecution. And if even one of the many crimes that Cohen was talking about is true, Trump is in big trouble. And there's really a lot there to prosecute. And remember that Wednesday's testimony was just the stuff Cohen could say in public. In Tuesday and on Thursday, he testified before House committees in closed sessions, talking about things that he could not say in public and stuff that he knew about the Trump administration and Donald Trump and his family and his business dealings that he could not say in public. So there is a lot there. In addition, Cohen repeatedly mentioned Alan Weisselberg, the chief financial officer of Trump's business, and implicates him in a lot of these deals, from the Stormy Daniels payoff to the Trump Tower Moscow deal to Trump's dodgy tax schemes. In fact, some of the checks that Cohen produced for the committee had Weisselberg's signature on them, as well as Donald Trump Jr.'s. So they're both implicated in trying to disguise not just the Stormy Daniels payoff but also running it through as a business expense through the Trump Organization, which could put him in very serious trouble in terms of tax and financial fraud, depending on whether he included those payments as expenses reported on the Trump Organization's tax returns, or whether he included those as business expenses when he was making financial reports to whatever bank has loaned money to the Trump Organization. There could be some deeper financial scandals there. Most importantly, I think Weisselberg will know who Donald Trump and the Trump Organization owe money to, and that's going to tell us a whole lot about foreign influence on Donald Trump and his family. So I think Weisselberg should be the next person that gets subpoenaed to testify before the House Oversight and Reform Committee.
They also specifically asked him about documents like his tax returns, things like that, mm-hmm. presenting those to the House.
The House has tried to get their hands on a lot of material, and they're issuing subpoenas for a lot of material. So we'll see what they do eventually get access to.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Then luckily for Donald Trump, he was out of town during most
yes.
of that.
And, you know, that was by design. It seems to be very clear now. The mainstream media, the Republicans and the Trump and members of the Trump administration and the mainstream media all focused on the fact that, oh, poor Donald Trump having to sit in Vietnam at the Trump-Kim summit with North Korea and listen to Michael Cohen. He couldn't actually be in Washington, D.C. I think that's getting it backwards. I think he did not want to be in Washington, D.C. I think the reason that the summit with Kim was actually scheduled to take place over those 3 days in particular And that the day when he was supposed to actually strike the deal and shake hands and get a great photo op with Kim Jong-un was scheduled for the same day, the exact same day that Michael Cohen was testifying, was by design. And I think it was supposed to take the media's eye and Americans' attention off of anything that Michael Cohen would say. So that timing was, I think, intentional. And I think Kim Jong-un realized that. And he realized how really desperate Donald Trump was for a deal. And that's why he dug in his heels and said, okay, I'll give you Yongbyon if you remove all the sanctions. I think that he recognized how desperate Donald Trump was and that the timing backfired. Trump thought it would benefit him, but that it actually backfired. Now, there were some other issues here, too, that the mainstream media didn't cover. One is that there were not enough negotiations ahead of time to make sure that both sides knew what the other wanted and expected and to make sure that they both had points of agreement. The summit was rushed and pushed forward, and there really was not enough negotiation at lower levels. And we could really see that with the way Mike Pompeo had gone to North Korea earlier this year to try to sit down with them and say, okay, we want a list of what you guys have, you know, that what of what we're talking about, not just Yongbyon, which is the known nuclear site in North Korea where they do their plutonium processing, but all of the other so-called secret sites that U.S. intelligence knows about, but that North Korea has not admitted to having. So sites where they enrich uranium, sites where they store already manufactured warheads. And that's the first step. You know, decades of nuclear agreements and nuclear negotiations have proven that step number one is you get a list and you verify that that list is accurate of what resources what nuclear resources that country has. And Mike Pompeo tried to do that earlier this year, and the North Koreans put him off and said, no, we don't have anything. All we have is that Yongbyon. We don't have anything else. And U.S. intelligence agencies were saying, look, we have photographs. We know what you have. You know, just own up to it. And they would not say that. And then Donald Trump stepped in and he said, oh, a list isn't necessary, because he wanted to move the summit ahead. And that's really the perils of doing business on a one-to-one basis, one dictator to another. Personal relationships won't get complex political agreements drafted and signed if you throw out the rule book, rule number one being get a list, verify that list. Then you're not going to get an agreement, or you're not going to get a good agreement. And so Trump sat down at that table thinking, I've got a great agreement, which is, you know, dismantle Yongbyon in exchange for lifting the sanctions. And it was his other negotiators on the American team who said, no, whoa, wait a minute. What about all the secret facilities? And you can't lift all sanctions when they still have these secret facilities and secret stores of nuclear warheads, or else you're never going to have any leverage over them to admit that they have those and to give those up. And Trump sat there and realized, oh, I'm on the verge of making a bad deal. So he had to walk away. That's really how it went down. And it's not how you heard it played out in the media. And I think that's really unfortunate that the media still is buying the image of Donald Trump as the maverick negotiator, when really, I think, he's the narcissist negotiator who thinks that he can get it done when no one else can, who does not follow a rule book, who does not have the intellectual capacity to understand the complexity of the issues and what he's negotiating on, and who finds himself continually in these situations where he's faced with a bad deal or no deal, you know, and then he has to walk away.
Well, that's what happens when you have somebody else ghostwrite the art of the deal.
Yeah, and I think he's kind of on the verge of that happening with the Chinese trade talks, with the trade talks with China as well. He's been continually trying to get around Robert Lighthizer, his very experienced trade negotiator, who's dealing with the Chinese on trade issues. And he keeps trying to get around him and say, hey, come to Mar-a-Lago and talk to me, in which case he's signaling to the Chinese that the Americans really don't have a clue and don't really know what they're doing in these negotiations.
All right. Do you have any events?
No.
All right. Well, we are unfortunately out of time then.
Yeah.
All right. So you're back next week, or we're going to find out next week?
Yeah, next week I'll be here, and then I may be taking some time off.
All right.